Ann Carrick in today for Paul Pacelli. Just like yesterday and again tomorrow, we're going to change directions. Instead of talking about earthquakes and fires and global warming and climate change, as if that's not scary enough, we're going to talk about the Middle East. And so joining me on the phone is Munir Zam, and thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Ann.
So let me ask you first, do you have me on a speakerphone or something? I can hear myself echoing in the background.
I don't.
Okay, we'll check that on our end. No, it could be on our end. I'll check that. I just, if it was you, I thought that's an easy fix. If it's on our end, we'll have to do a little investigation there. So I asked you to join us because you often have different sources and different views of what's going on in the Middle East. So let me ask you first, where are you sourcing these, since they're kind of not the traditional view of things that we hear so often in the news? I mean, are you seeking out different information from different places, just so we know what perspective you're coming from?
Certainly, Anne. It is just an array of different information that extends back to some of the college courses that I've had, my background on my father's side is from the Middle East. He was born in what was then Palestine, and came to this country by way of Lebanon, and so certainly have access to information that comes directly out of the Middle East. But for the most part, I get a lot of information from, for example, National Public Radio has a very interesting podcast called Throughline, which sort of ties history to events that are going on today. An array of different sources from, some of the universities, particularly in the Boston area, like Harvard and MIT.
Well, I know you sent me a link to this one that's truthout.org, which, and I didn't have a chance to look at all of it because I was already on the air. But, who actually maintains this site? Do you know, who keeps the information up to date on it?
So that's an interview with Noam Chomsky, who is an MIT professor and a professor at the University of Arizona. Truth Out is its own organization.
All right. That's why I was just trying to figure out where your information is coming from, because, I think it's good for everyone to hear different viewpoints and different versions of the same information so they can draw their own conclusion. But when you're talking, when I'm talking to somebody like you, where you're probably going to say things that are not what they're used to hearing, the immediate question is going to be like, well, why does he think that? So it's just trying to give them a little information. Let's start with the most recent events. The United States authorizes a hit on a high-level Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani, who's in Iraq at the time, which probably already confuses people because he's from Iran, but he's in Iraq when we hit him. And so the United States takes him out, which, on the surface, you're kind of like, why are we, going around the world taking out people? I mean, I know why. I know the answer. But I'm not looking for somebody to call and tell me the answer. I understand. But so from our standpoint, what the most of the information that comes out is, he was planning all these attacks that were against U.S. Troops and assets that are in the area. Is that the same perspective that you're hearing from some of the sources that we were talking about, that where you're getting your information, or are they viewing that differently?
Well, the fact that Iran has plans through their proxy forces that they have in Iran and Syria and Lebanon is nothing new. As I would expect, the U.S. has a whole range of different plans and scenarios that they're looking at to respond to world events. The Iranians are very much in the same way. And I think what you're hearing in the news today is whether the threat was imminent. And everything that I'm hearing, and this is from, you know, national news, is that it, you know, there was no real evidence that anything was imminent.
Well, that's always the argument. And part of the issue is that everything is so politicized right now that it's very hard for anyone to know what's the truth, because you have, you know, one side saying it was imminent, that's why we did it, and the other side saying that's just garbage. There's not true at all. And somewhere in the middle lies the truth, I'm sure.
I mean, in this case, I'm not sure that it really does lie in the middle. I think that it's important to really question why we took this really drastic action at this time without really compelling evidence. I mean, this is, you know, that this, if it wasn't something imminent, it's just a clear violation of the War Powers Act. It's well known in Iran. I mean, while the people really disdain the government and the situation they're in, they actually respected this General Soleimani quite a bit, as in Iraq, because, I mean, he certainly operated these proxy forces. But you have to keep in mind, he was largely responsible for defeating ISIS in Iraq. And I think people forget that. But it was much more the Iranians and the Shia militia than the U.S. in the case of Iraq. Now, the U.S. obviously, you know, fought ISIS in Syria, but they first had to fall in Iraq. And that is also General Soleimani and why he's viewed as a hero, unlike the rest of the government. And so
which is understandable that the people would view him as a hero if he got rid of ISIS. You know, that, because I don't know anybody who's government-wise who would be a supporter of ISIS. Only ISIS is supportive of ISIS. I don't know anybody else.
Yeah.
Well, no, but you know what I'm saying. You know, I don't. I mean, it seems like everybody else, governments, the general people, nobody else is a fan. You know,
right? But the U.S. created, you know, they just created a martyr out of this fellow for the Iranian people. When, for the most part, the government was on their heels. So it, you know, in many regards, it bolstered support for the Iranian government, where we didn't, it was really in trouble. So it's unclear to me just as to why we would have assassinated Soleimani at that, you know, at this particular point in time, for any reasons in support of some stability or some real true imminent threat that was somehow more impending than in the past.
What would be your best guess? And I realize this is just your opinion, but of why we did why we did assassinate Soleimani in 15 seconds or less, and then we're going to check traffic. But, you know,
I think it has as much to do with the politics here creating a distraction as much as anything else.
Okay.
Wag the dog. Three words.
All right. That's why I know it's your opinion. I just wanted to ask.
We're going to take my opinion.
Okay. Well, and they're allowed. Everyone's allowed to have their opinions. It's a free country. That's the whole point. Well, Paul's not solving any problems today because he's enjoying some time off. And Carrick here, and I'm speaking with Munir Zam. And you know what? If you and I can solve the problem in the Middle East in an hour, we need to be paid more money.
Here, here.
If we come up with a solution in the next 50 minutes or 45 minutes, we need a raise.
That's it.
So you said, I asked you right before we went to the break, why do you think we assassinated Soleimani? And you said you think it was just a distraction, a whole wag the dog kind of thing to take attention off of. I mean, I could name several things that are going on right now. Do you have one in mind or just all of them?
Well, certainly. I mean, of course, the impeachment trial.
Sure, I mean, impeachment, election.
Large.
Right, okay.
Right. You know, so, yes, there's there's a lot of politics, and there's an election coming up, and so the timing is really quite suspicious to pick this particular point in time.
There's some twisted irony in the fact that it's a Ukrainian airline that accidentally was shot down when the whole impeachment process was based on a phone call to Ukraine. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying there's any connection, but it's like, what a twist of irony that it's a Ukrainian airline. Anyway,
right. That certainly crossed my mind. And I think that this is, this is an evidence, very tragic incident is just evidence of hair-triggered situation, tensions that are escalated. People do very stupid things with particularly when they have very powerful weapons.
I think most people can see how, it is tragic, but they can see how it played out. The U.S. assassinates Soleimani. Iran responds with missiles. The U.S. threatens you, hurt any of our people or our assets, and we're going to fire back, strong. And this airplane happens into airspace, I assume by mistake. I don't know. I know U.S. carriers were told to avoid the area, but Ukrainian maybe didn't think there was an issue, but whatever. And that Iran says, oh, here comes the U.S. response. Boom. They shoot it out of the sky before anybody has a chance to figure out what it is.
Yeah, no, and I certainly haven't gotten into exact details. I only heard that the pilot banked a little tighter than he should have and the like, and that they are now arresting the people who are allegedly responsible for shooting down the aircraft.
Yeah, I heard that too, and I always wonder, especially when it's a government that doesn't operate like ours, so certainly not familiar with how Iran's government does things internally. If that's for show, are they arresting them to sort of make it look like to the world that, okay, we're going to punish these people?
Right. Yeah, and that may be. Keep in mind, we did shoot down an Iranian airliner in the 1980s, late 1980s, in a very similar fashion. And was accountable for it.
Right.
And I actually don't know if and how any of the people directly responsible were reprimanded for it here.
Yeah.
It would have been impossible for, I think, the Iranians to deny it ultimately.
Well, they tried at first. I think the evidence became overwhelming even as they were trying to keep foreigners away from the crash site and not share data from the black boxes and all that other kind of stuff. I think it just became overwhelming. There was just no way. They probably knew that sooner or later it was going to come out. Better to just admit it.
Right.
It's a mistake. I don't think anyone is accusing them of purposely shooting down a passenger plane. Everything I've heard and everybody's opinion seems to be that, yes, they all kind of agree it was a mistake, that it was unintentional.
Right, and particularly with so many Iranians there. And
you mean on board?
On board,
yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. And I'm, I actually am friends with several people from Iran, still play soccer with them on a regular basis.
And you admit that. I'm just teasing.
Yeah. Oh, no. We have the whole United Nations on the soccer field. I think there may be the solution, Anne.
We all need to play soccer. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly. Oh. No, I think we can solve a lot of the world's problems on the soccer field.
On a soccer field. Okay. We have. We're only 23 minutes in and we've solved the problem.
That's right.
So, do you find it strange or with the whole back and forth? To me, there was all this threatening going on after the assassination of Soleimani. It almost seemed, and this is, I have absolutely no facts to back this up. This just, it looks this way in my mind. This is what popped up. That it was almost like we said, okay, we understand you have to fire missiles at us to show that you're upset. Like, don't hit anything. Let us know where they're going. We move all our stuff out of the way. They fire all these missiles. They hit nothing. They save face, and we say, okay, we're going to slap your hand with some sanctions.
Right. I think that was absolutely the plan. The situation with the aircraft sort of got in the way, but I think, Iran had to do something. And if you look at sort of over the last 3 years, particularly, since Donald Trump took office, they have moved very, very carefully on the chessboard. They've been.
You say they, you mean Iran.
Been aggressive.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Iran.
Yeah.
Exactly. Iran is not in a position of strength by any means. And they certainly don't want a direct conflict. They have been keep in mind, Iran is where chess was invented. They have moved quite carefully on the chessboard as to, how they've acted, against the nuclear agreement. They've been very measured in the way that they've sort of violated it, so it didn't trigger responses from the other country, other signatories to it.
That is a piece of information, by the way, that I did not know, that chess was invented in Iran.
Yes, it was. That's right.
Maybe that's why so many people in the U.S. are misunderstanding what's going on with countries in the Middle East, because it's all a big chess game and we're just not following along closely. I don't know. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli, and my guest this hour is Munir Azam, and we're talking about all things Iran and Iraq, including the fact that chess was created in Iran. A little tidbit there that we didn't know that before, or I didn't, so I'm assuming some other people didn't. Maybe I'm the only one who is not in the know. But as far as the relationship with the United States and the Middle East, so Munir, we were talking about the fact that you were saying Iran isn't, they knew they weren't really working from a position of power in this latest back and forth between the assassination of Soleimani and the missile launch against bases in Iraq. So you think they were being very calculated in what they did because they knew they weren't in a position of power?
Right, right. And the government has to really, they're sort of walking on a knife's edge between a very, unsettled population who've been suffering under the sanctions and, for all intents and purposes, a pretty oppressive government, and responding, sort of matching their responses with rhetoric. I believe that the reports in Iran were that their missile strikes did a lot more damage than actually occurred on those bases.
Wait a minute. So you're saying that their reports that there was more damage than what we reported as damage?
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah. And which, do you have a third opinion that causes you to lean one direction or the other? Which one you think is true?
Oh, I am sure that the U.S. Reporting is a lot more accurate than what Iran is reporting to,
on the amount of damage
their population. But it allowed them to say, okay, we responded and look at this damage that we've done.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Right. And Iran is also, as part of their statement is, their intention is to get the U.S. out of the region. And, it's certainly worthwhile understanding the history, of the United States in Iran and the Middle East, in the case of Iran, it goes back to 1953, and it's really quite an amazing story that I reference in that podcast on Throughline.
Right. Can you tell us briefly what that? I'm looking at it, but you obviously know it by heart.
Yes, yes, yes. No, very briefly. England had all the oil rights in Iran back then, and England the empire was crumbling after World War II. They had elected a democratic government. President Mossadegh wanted to take back the oil resources
of his own country.
Exactly.
Right.
Of his own country. England was not in a position to sort of preserve it and enlisted the U.S. and the Eisenhower administration. In fact, the Truman administration rejected it, the opportunity, but Eisenhower was very fearful of Russia getting involved in one way or the other. And so they decided that the best thing was to overthrow the Mossadegh government, even though it was really embodied all of the principles of the American democracy. And it's an amazing story where Kermit Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt's nephew, paid his own money to stage a coup and overthrew the president and brought back the Shah, who ruled over the country, in a tyrannical way. So
now,
it's quite
now
a story.
For people who are listening, who they remember the Shah, there's a lot of people who probably don't. They probably have a very different version of that same story that you just told, from what they were told, as far as the U.S. supporting the return of the Shah, and then all of the great things the Shah supposedly did for Iran.
Yes. I mean, there is, in effect, that happens after that that coup d'etat, and leading right up to when the Shah was overthrown. But while he was doing great things for Iran on the global stage, he was, jailing and imprisoning hordes of people
inside the country. You know, right. So an outward looking face that looks like great stuff, but internally doing a lot of damage to his own people. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli today. Our guest this hour, Munir Azam, and we're talking about Iran, Iraq, and things that happened in the Middle East and trying to get a little different perspective on it. So, Munir, you're telling me, or you're telling all of us, that to summarize. So in 1953, post-World War II, the UK has control of oil fields in Iran, and with the United States, they decide to overthrow the elected prime minister and reinstate the Shah, who I guess had been in power before, who then stays in power for 25 years until 1979, when there's the revolution and the infamous students, as they always call them, decide to overthrow the Shah. And that's, of course, when the Iran hostage situation, where they have the U.S. embassy and U.S. citizens are taken hostage at the embassy. Did I summarize that accurately for you?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm.
So again, I don't know that anybody has ever had it explained that way. I think usually it was explained that the U.S. supported the Shah. I don't remember why. I don't remember ever hearing why we supported the Shah. And then we were also talking about how outwardly facing things that the Shah of Iran was doing looked like he was making all these great improvements to the country and doing all these, like Iran was growing and, commercial business was growing and people were prospering. But at the same time, what we didn't see or chose perhaps not to look at was that he was imprisoning anybody who disagreed with him and torturing people and doing other things that we certainly would not have condoned publicly. And I don't know do you think we turned a blind eye to that, or did we not know?
No, absolutely. We turned a blind eye. I mean, in fact, we trained the SAVAK. The CIA and the SAVAK had a close relationship. And the reason is very simple. It was control of the oil resources. You have to remember that was also the time of the Arab oil embargo.
And the gas shortage.
Well,
time frame, but yes.
Yeah, the embargo that created the gasoline shortage, and Iran played a critical role in keeping the oil flowing. That relationship between the U.S. and Iran was a check to what was, about the supplies that were cut in Saudi Arabia.
So one more reason to not be dependent on foreign oil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is exactly true.
So let me just throw this out there, since we haven't mentioned them at all, Israel. Do you think anything with Soleimani and the follow-on missile attacks and everything, did Israel play any part in any of that? Because they're almost always drawn into this conversation, and I've heard very little about them in all the entire incident.
Yes. So Israel is integral to this whole discussion, at the center of the concern is the prospect of nuclear weapons, and in a way, that's where the major threat is the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
And who has them? Yeah.
The challenge is that Israel is the only country that has them. It's not acknowledged by the United States or by Israel, although everybody else is fully aware of it.
You're talking about in the region, that Israel is the only one who really has nuclear weapons.
Right.
And the rest of what we hear about, and again, I realize it's your opinion, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, you know, neither of us are, you know, testifying under oath here. It's just our opinions. But what you're saying is, so, you know, in the region, it's pretty common knowledge for sure. And I get the impression you're saying that even other countries outside the region know it, but they don't admit it, is that Israel is the only one with nuclear weapons, and the other countries, you know, we worry about them having nuclear weapons and talk like they might, but they don't really.
Yes, that's right. I think that I recently read that all the other countries would, forsake developing nuclear weapons as long as Israel did as well. That's the issue with acknowledging that Israel has them. And it's pretty well documented, even in U.S. Magazines and the like.
That Israel does, in fact, have them, you mean?
Yeah. Seymour Hersh did some very detailed reporting on the fact that they have them. And it goes all the way back to the Kennedy administration. I don't think it's just that sort of goes beyond. It certainly goes beyond my opinion. It's pretty strong sense of that. The challenge is that if we acknowledge it here, then we can't, by the Symington Amendment, we can't provide aid to Israel. For as long as they maintain nuclear weapons.
So what you're, just to clarify what you're saying for people listening, is, you know, if we admitted that Israel has nuclear weapons, if the United States says, oh yeah, they have them, then we would no longer be able to provide them aid, which we currently are doing and that they continue to want. And so if we deny that they have them, then we can still give them that aid and that help and whatever we're giving them.
Correct.
Okay. I'm just rephrasing it so make sure people understand what we're saying.
Right. So that but that is the underlying tension and why Iran has been sort of pressing and keeping that nuclear development on the table.
Well, because it's to their benefit to make it sound like they're under imminent threat of a nuclear attack. And that they don't have nuclear weapons to defend themselves so that they continue to get help from the United States.
Exactly. So they have their own wag the dog scenario.
There's a lot of dog wagging going on here, you know? It goes back to that chess game, I'm telling you. Everybody.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely right. It's just, this is geopolitical chess.
Do you think that people in the United States, in a general sense, I'm going to generalize everybody, quick yes or no answer, do you think that they don't realize the game that's being played in the Middle East. I mean, I called it a chess game, but in some ways it is, that they're operating under a different set of rules than we're used to.
Absolutely. I think that the general public really doesn't understand those details.
Okay.
At all.
All right. Well,
and it's complicated.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely complicated. Okay. I'm in for Paul Pacelli today, and I'm Ann Carrick. My guest this hour has been Munir Azam. And we've been talking about Iran and Iraq and Israel and shedding a little light on why things happen the way they do and from a slightly different perspective. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about at all, Munir, is the religious aspect of this, you know, where obviously a lot of the countries are predominantly Muslim, but even within that, there's the different, you know, the different type of Muslims groups, the Sunnis and all this stuff, where they don't really get along either. And of course, Israel being predominantly a Jewish country, you know, we haven't really touched on that at all. Does that play into this a lot or not as much as we think?
You also have to mention the Christians as well.
Sorry, I forgot all about them. Yes, because they're everywhere. I forgot about them. I'm sorry.
That's right. Well, they're playing a sort of an increasingly smaller role. But this is really my opinion. The religion, it plays an increasingly smaller role. It is the powers that be, the regimes in power that are taking advantage of the divisions within the religion where they can.
They're just using the conflict between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Jews and the Christians to their advantage, but it's not really
exactly
as big a factor. Okay.
Yes. That's my view. I am Christian myself, but I work with any number of Jews and Muslims, both of the Sunni and Shia type. And boy, the differences in so many ways are quite small.
Right. And, years ago, I think it was 2001 after the 9/11 attacks, somebody, which is a little suspicious, without saying anything, they sent me a book about that was like on all different religions. And of course, it came in a padded envelope that had broken. So it was like kind of leaking powdery material. I'm like, great, this is exactly the kind of package I want at work right after 9/11. But the book itself was very interesting. And if you kind of looked at it, you realized there were many more similarities between all religions than there are differences. And so maybe that's one aspect that's improving in the area, which is that the religious aspect of it is becoming less important. But the political and economic factors are, from what you're saying, you think are what really driving the decisions and the actions.
That's right. And I don't want to understate the role of religion. It's just that behind it all are few people that are trying to retain their power and their position by manipulating the religions, and it's on all sides.
Meaning all the different religions or all the different regimes.
All the different regimes, and the religions. Benjamin Netanyahu is no saint either. He's under indictment for several credible charges. So,
I saw a movie recently that I think it's called King Bibi. I believe it's like an independent film, all about Netanyahu. From his early days as like an aide to some elected official to where he is now. Very interesting. I learned a lot more about him than I ever knew, for sure. So if anybody wants to know more about him, I would highly suggest that movie, King Bibi. And we're going to break again for traffic, and we come back with a very small amount of time. But if somebody wants to find out more information, think about what would be the easiest way for them, like if they've listened to us and they want to know more about what we're talking about, if you have a suggestion. All right. As promised, before we check news at the top of the hour, We're going to get, so Munir Azam, we've been talking about all these things about the Middle East, probably very different perspectives than a lot of people have heard. If they want to see more about what we're talking about, do you have any suggestions for them?
Yeah, I would suggest this podcast called Throughline from the National Public Radio. There was one episode that was early in the program that I think goes back to October of last year or even earlier, July of last year, about it's essentially how the CIA overthrew the government in 4 days.
All right, I'm looking at it on the screen. It's February 7th, 2019. So if somebody's looking for it, that's the date on it.
There you go.
Okay.
There's a book called Oil Kings, and I forget the author at the moment, but it's a big, thick book, but it takes you through the whole history, particularly in Iran and the Shah and the Nixon administration. That is really very interesting, well-researched book. So those are two things that I would recommend.
All right. I've already recommended King Bibi the movie.
King Bibi the movie, that's right.
And what about truthout.org?
That article is very interesting. Noam Chomsky is a wealth of information from alternative sources. And I would recommend he's written and read widely. He's got some amazing information and perspectives that
so your suggestion is more Noam Chomsky than the website, because we have like 5 seconds.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Munir Azam.